Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome to the next episode of Deer University. Today we have a really hot topic, or at least we think it's a really hot topic. It's about culling. The do's and don'ts, the when to and when not to, the why and the how and on and on. But we're going to explain when to cull and when not to. And if you even can cull, we're going to get into that. What does that even mean? And Steve, you know, over the years, I'm trying to think of a topic around the campfire or at the deer camp or at the coffee shop that people talk more about, maybe discuss more, maybe have the most misinformation about as well, is culling. And so you typically also see that, Steve, in my opinion, you see that a lot as an excuse. You know, it's real easy if you made a mistake. You know, with you harvested the wrong buck, well, that was a good cull buck. Or here's a good one. You hear it all the time. You read about it all the time. You see it on TV all the time. It was really good. I removed that buck from the gene pool.
Yep. Yeah. And a dirty little secret about the biologist world is we've been in the biologist world discussing this among ourselves for decades as well. So it's not just it's not just a hunter's talking about it and arguing about it and trying to understand, is it something you should or shouldn't do and when should you do it? It's not even, 100% of the biologists, the deer biologists out there don't necessarily agree on this either.
Yeah, especially regarding for bucks, buck sure. management and so forth. But Steve as well, probably goes back 20, 30, 40 years as well. We didn't call it, or people back then didn't call it culling per se. They might have used the term selective harvest.
Yeah, and we like to use that word, that term in biological, as deer biologists, because it's maybe a little cleaner.
I think it's more flexible.
Well, yeah, that's
true. You know
true
what
too.
I mean? It can apply to different aspects. So selective harvest could mean, real simply, that everybody does. It might just mean we're selecting more does.
That's right.
But it kind of means there's a targeted, intentional, you know, there's a strategic type of animal for whatever purpose you have that you want to remove
yes.
from the population.
Yeah, and that hit way back into the early days of deer restoration, there were, in fact, way back in the 1600s, the very first selective harvest regulation was put in place in the colony of Rhode Island, where they eliminated the harvest of certain types of deer during a certain time of the year. That was a selective harvest back in the 1600s. And so we're talking way back. That's almost as old as I am.
Yeah, you're the only one that could remember that.
Yeah, I almost remember that.
Yeah.
but seriously, during the period of restoration, buck only harvest, once there was a population established, it was only buck harvest. Back when I was first getting into hunting in Mississippi was the period in the late 70s when the agencies were just starting to open up doe harvest. They realized that there were an adequate number of deer in the landscape and we needed to remove some, but they didn't want to just go wide open. So they would have a doe day. And on one day a year out of the county, you could shoot a doe.
Selective harvest.
Selective harvest, exactly.
And so even if you're moving, let's get away from differentiating buck harvest versus doe harvest, you can exercise selective harvest if you only want to shoot mature bucks.
That's right.
Selective harvest.
Yes.
So where does culling, where does the word culling come into play? I think we'll get into that a little bit more. So it might mean that culling is a type of selective harvest.
Yes.
You might say that.
Yeah. It's just a specific type of selective harvest.
Yeah. A particular type of animal is targeted.
Yeah.
Called a cull.
A special case.
Yeah.
For selective harvest.
Hey, and let's give a disclaimer right here, Steve, that there's a negative connotation a lot of people have, and I respect that, by using the word cull.
Yeah. That's why I said selective harvest is cleaner.
Yeah.
It doesn't offend anybody. Some purists in the deer world don't like to use the term culling because it suggests an inferiority in a type of animal. And, you know, I get that. I get that. I love every deer. I appreciate every deer. I respect every deer I've harvested. They eat really well, regardless of, you know, which side of the average distribution that they happen to fall on.
And they hunt the same.
That's right.
The hunt is just as good and they eat just as well. So, yeah. That's probably borrowed too, Steve. I'm off the cuff here. I don't know this. I haven't researched it. That's probably from the livestock literature, I'm sure. Yeah. Culling something out of the herd.
Yeah. And it even goes into the timber industry, where you come in and you thin a stand as it's growing towards maturity, you thin and you cull out the inferior trees.
Mm-hmm.
And a timber biologist, a forester doesn't mind calling a tree that has some disease or is a little crooked early.
Or just
in
its growth rate.
Yeah, just slower growth rate.
Below average.
It's an inferior tree. But, you know, there's a huge amount of aesthetics and pleasure and emotions tied in with deer and deer hunting. And so just some people don't like to refer to any deer as inferior. And I get that. But we have to categorize and discuss. You know, we can't just say shoot deer. If that's what our listeners are doing, then they don't need to listen to us. We need to have terminology that differentiates types of deer.
All right. I think we've cleared that point up. So we're not saying anything derogatory about the animal per se. We're just saying that it possesses a characteristic or attribute that does not meet or fulfill the objectives, the management objectives for the property.
Exactly, because every harvest decision should be tied back to the management goals for a property.
That's exactly right. Well, over the years, Steve, we've really sunk our teeth into this, heck, close to 20 years, but certainly the past 15 or so, we've really delved into this topic, and I guess probably one of our favorite topics we talk about. And one of the topics we see that a lot of people need help with,
and yes,
we're going to go into detail about that later. When we're giving seminars, and for that matter, when we're writing articles, we like to break selective harvest into two categories. And we talk about there is selective harvest for genetic improvement, which is what most people think they are doing when they're making a cull decision or a selective harvest decision. They are improving the genetics of the herd. And then we have this other category that we call selective harvest to improve the standing crop. Now, we'll get to the standing crop in a moment. What exactly is the standing crop? Let's go back to genetic improvement. So that's the word we use, genetic improvement. What might be some other ways to describe genetic improvement? What does that mean?
Well, when I think about it, it means through a harvest of a group or type of animal, we're going to affect the probability of that type of animal being produced in the future. And if we're culling a category of animal, then we're going to be reducing the probability that those kind of animals are going to be produced in the future. And if we're not culling a category of animals, then we're hoping that we're going to increase the probability of those types of animals being produced in the future. So we're really affecting the genetic probability of a future population.
May I be a little bit more nerdy?
Sure.
Yeah. Not usually don't have that problem. Anyway, no comment needed from you on that. If you go back to high school biology or certainly college biology, you might have to dig a little deep here, but the genotype. So what you're really trying to do is promote a particular or the prevalence of a genotype in the population. Genes controlling, you know, eventually what that animal, genes affecting the phenotype, what the animal's going to look like.
Yeah.
And so by selective harvest, you hope or your intentions are to influence which animals are breeding, right?
That's right.
You're trying to influence, hey, that buck has a genotype. Typically, we're talking about antlers. And I want that buck to sire more offspring such that his offspring or that genotype will be more frequent in the population.
Exactly.
So that's
not very nerdy.
That wasn't very nerdy? Okay.
Yeah.
But you're kind of nerdy too, so it's a relative scale there. So let's talk. Let's break that down a little bit. So for that to occur, Steve, some genetic improvement, something has to be heritable.
That's right.
We just published a paper. Actually, our student Eric Mitchell published the paper and took the lead on that. But there are some things, some characteristics, whether it be in a human being, a deer, or a cow, or whatever, tree, that are highly heritable and some that aren't highly heritable. So what about deer and antlers? Can we presume that, let's say, Papa Deer has got a 150-inch frame, 10 points. Can we just assume that his offspring, his male offspring, are going to have 150-inch antlers, 10-inch frame?
Absolutely not. From our research, though, we showed that their antler characteristics are moderately heritable, which means that, you know, a good amount of the time there is going to be that inheritance, but not every time. So you can't, just because a buck is a 150 class buck, his offspring are not all going to be 150 class bucks. And then even within a population of bucks, there's variation in how much effective expression of their genes they have in the production of offspring. And if you look at some human families, you know, there's a mom and a dad and three kids, and all three kids look like the mom. And another family, all three kids look like the dad. That's because the mom or the dad had a higher, what the livestock people call, breeding value. And some individuals have a high breeding value that they more readily express their genetic potential. And that's why the characteristics of antler size are only moderately heritable on average, because some are really highly heritable individually, but others are not. And when you average it out, it's just moderately heritable.
So can we safely say, and please correct me if you don't agree with this, Steve, can we safely say that when we say heritable or highly heritable or moderately heritable, we are talking about a population that is a general trend, a general value, that they are moderately. But as we have seen, you have some individuals, getting back to this breeding value, you have some individuals that we've seen in the deer pens where they have a terrible breeding value.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's almost like individually their heritability appears to be very low for antler traits.
Yes.
And then you might have others where their breeding value or their individual heritability, you know, looks to be very high.
Yes.
Okay. So now let's go a little further. So we've got the term, the process heritability. We then have, for an individual buck or sire, do they have a high breeding value or low breeding value? Now we got this other part of the equation. Dad's only providing half the genetic package here.
Yes.
How about mom?
Mom is absolutely providing 50% of the genetic material that produces antler size and body size, but she also provides more than 50% of the impact because she's providing lactation and the training basically of that fawn and the provision of that fawn in terms of seeking out hiding cover and foraging opportunities for the fawn. So she's providing 50% of the genetics plus that early life experience that the buck has nothing to do with. So the female is extremely important in that genotype and how it's expressed in the physical makeup or what we like to call phenotype.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's apply some of this. And again, we're going to get back to the standing crop, but while we're on genetics, let's stay on this topic. So let's talk about a scenario when genetic manipulation or breeding for genetics works. How would you broadly classify, Steve? When does it work?
Well, it absolutely works in a breeding pen where you can control a male breeding a female. And ideally, that male is not just expressing good genetics, but comes from a long line of males and females that, one, express good genetics for antler development in either themselves or their offspring if it's the female, but also have high breeding values for those characteristics. And so, in other words, a male with big antlers but a low breeding value isn't going to be really any good at improving genetics of his offspring. He just happened to have good genes, but he doesn't contribute them in an effective way.
The stars align for him, but he, on a population scale, he's a flash in the pan.
That's right.
It's him, but in terms of his genes enduring and being expressed in the population, very, very low.
Very low. So a breeding pen where you have control over lineage and you have a constant environment so that animals are able to express their genetic potential. So by a constant environment, I'm talking about good quality nutrition year-round, year after year. So they're able to express their genetics accurately. If you have a wild situation and extreme variation from year to year, you could have good genetics, but poorly expressed because of a particularly bad year in which a male was fawned or, you know, produced, and he was stunted, and so he can't express his genetics. So in that breeding pen, you can control that variation. You can control who's breeding who, and there have been some extreme cases of improved or larger antler size being produced.
Well, one thing I would add, Steve, and I don't know if I'm adding to or explaining further something you said, or maybe you didn't say it, but so in the breeding pen, of course, you have control. So that number one, you get to control who's breeding who. But along with that is you have information.
Yeah.
You know on the sire side, you know what were the characteristics of the father, you know the breeding value of the father, and then you know the same information for the mother.
Yes.
You know, so you know her pedigree as well. What on average do her sons look like? And then you get to match those up. So, and that mimics livestock. How many thousands of years has that been going on in our livestock industry?
That's right.
Doing the same thing.
Yeah. And one of the phrases we like to use is you can't manage what you don't measure. And if you're measuring all these characteristics in individual deer, generation after generation within a breeding pen, you can manage it. And that's why there's success in breeding pens. And you can get online and see some, now I get into my aesthetics, my personal
philosophy,
and you know, I don't necessarily like what I see when I get online and see some of these abnormally large, huge sets of, especially the non-typical antlers that are being produced in breeding pens and sold in certain markets. But the fact is, it can be done. Whether or not it should be done is a philosophical and ethical question. But it can be done.
But biologically, it can be done because you have information and you have control.
That's right.
Okay.
If the buck can't happen to walk well and hold his head up because his antlers are so large, that's an ethical issue in my mind. But that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about management for genetics.
Well, I got to say this since you said that.
Okay.
That would also be a characteristic if it can't hold his head up. Obviously, Mother Nature would never select for that. Mother Nature would never allow that in the wild because a buck that can't hold his head up won't live.
That's right.
So that's why you don't see those types of antlers perpetuated, at least with any great abundance. I mean, there's always an outlier and a wild card, but that's why you don't see that.
Exactly.
They can't live with those antlers.
That's right.
All right, Steve, so we covered when it can work. And we covered why it can work within a breeding facility where you have 100% control of who's breeding who. Let's take it now to what 95, 99% of the applications for hunters. It's not a breeding pen and it's not a high fence. It's in the wild.
That's right.
And this, let's start off with where we left off in the previous episode. So now let's get back to some basic biology of the breeding system of deer, specifically bucks, and how that could impact whether or not culling and selective harvest would be effective in a wild population.
Well, yeah, in the breeding pen, we had control over who's breeding. And it, as we talked in our last podcast, there's not a lot of control over who's doing the breeding in a wild situation. There's a lot of bucks doing the breeding, and antler size isn't a major driving force in who's doing the breeding. So if you have a
Let's hammer that home, Steve. We talked about it in the last episode. Let's hammer it home again. So a buck with above average antlers that does not in any way, shape, or form say or dictate that he's going to have above average breeding success. That is critical.
Yes.
Critical.
Hammered.
Okay.
Hammered. So if you don't have a system where unique individuals are doing the disproportionate amount of the breeding, then you lose that ability of control, like we talked about. And even within a population, say somebody has a 1,000 acres or 500 acres where they're selectively removing certain animals and allowing others to do the breeding, the offspring that are produced on that property, the male offspring specifically, 50 to 60, maybe 70% of those buck fawns are going to disperse off of that property. So they're not producing their future population. They're producing offspring that are probably going to leave and disperse elsewhere. You know, maybe 3 to 5 miles, and if you're in an area with a lot of agriculture and small woodlots, it's been documented deer disperse 15 to 20 miles. So you're not managing your breeding population at all with your selective harvest.
So these, I've got air quotes going here, these genetically improved buck fawns, you know, you're genetically improved, you think, by your selective harvest. These genetically improved buck fawns aren't even going to grow up on your property. They're going to grow up on your neighbor's property.
Probably
or two or three neighbors away from you on property. So what bucks are going to be coming to your property?
The bucks produced on an adjacent property,
yeah.
3 to 5 miles away. And when you add into that, you've got the breeding variation, you've got dispersal, and plus you've got the total lack of information on the doe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no criteria that you can use reasonably to predict the genetics for antler size of male offspring of a doe.
Right. You may look at her. She may be, I'm comparing this with what we talked about with bucks. So it may be an above average body size doe. You may think, well, heck, that's a really, really big doe. I'm sure she's going to produce really big offspring. Well, heck, her breeding value could be lower, right?
That's right.
You have no guarantee as to what her offspring are going to look like.
Yeah. So the bottom line, in the wild, there's a lot of reasons why genetic management shouldn't work. But it's just really difficult to prove that it did or didn't work in the wild. And it's hard to do in the wild.
My gosh, wouldn't it be great if we could manipulate deer in the wild to do this? But it would take us probably, 100 years, and we would need about 100,000 acres or something like that to do it. And that's not happening anytime soon. But what can we do?
Well, yeah. Somebody as smart as you and
smarter than me because I didn't write the program.
That's right. Several years ago, you know, we brought in Stephen Webb, a doctoral student here at the Deer Lab. And our goal with him was to address this question using modeling. And for everyone, kind of describe what is a model. And how do we use it?
Well, I'm 6'2". Right now, I'm about 190 pounds. So I do some modeling from time to time. No.
yeah, you're also a bit of a fabricator of alternative facts.
Well, that may be my alternative reality I'm living in. Alternative facts, is that the joke right now?
Yeah.
Alternative facts?
Yeah.
A model is a characterization of reality. A model is a formula, or maybe you could say an algorithm. Bottom line, you come up with a model that you hope simulates or mimics in some way reality. Okay. And so there's no way we could do an experiment like this in our lifetime. But what we can do with modeling, and specifically simulation modeling, is we can work with people in the livestock industry who have developed these types of models, simulation models, where they can look at things like heritability, they can look at things like longevity, how many years a sire is going to live, how many times a sire is going to breed, what is the breeding value of the sire, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they can figure out how many generations it takes to see improvement. Now, with livestock, it may be weight gain. It might be for a cow, it might be milk yield. It might, you know, whatever the livestock industry trait they're looking for. But rather than them having to conduct the experiment and wait 15 years for the answer, they run a simulation model to give them some insight as to whether it's going to work or not. And so that's what we used. We got with those people and ran livestock models, but we ran it with deer.
That's right. We used genetic models developed in the livestock industry with proven effectiveness at giving a valid answer in cattle. Now, our first step was to prove that it worked in deer. And so we actually fed in all the background biological information. We won't go into all the details on all the data we had to put into it in terms of the biology of a deer, but we needed to test it with some breeding pens, and we had some controlled breeding data from Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and we proved that our model simulated the results that they generated through actual controlled breeding studies over a number of generations of deer.
So that validated that a livestock model used for cows, used for beef, would work for deer.
Absolutely. So we knew we had a performing model that represented reality in the wild for deer. So then we said, all right, if we're going to have a managed wild deer population, can it effectively be manipulated using selective harvest, culling, and actually improve antler size? And the model, one of the nice things about models is you can simulate years into the future. So we ran it for 20, or not we, the air quotes, we, mm-hmm. Stephen Webb, who is a lot smarter than both
you.
Of us.
All
right, certainly a lot smarter than me, ran it for 20 years. And after 20 years of intensive selective culling, so intensive that within the model actually knew what each offspring produced would ultimately grow into with absolute certainty, because it was mathematically generated. And so it would cull out the smaller antlered offspring at a very high rate. The model varied by year because it's a simulation and there is natural variation inserted into it. But up to 56% of the bucks within a given year were removed from the population.
That's intense.
That's hugely intense. Nobody in their right mind in a deer management situation would remove 50% of the buck population if they're trying to produce older aged bucks. You remove half of an age class every year and you
run out of bucks really quick.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So a large percentage of the bucks being selectively culled because they have smaller antlers with absolute certainty, 20 years of manipulation. And after 20 years, we had improved the genetic potential for antler production by less than one antler point. We went from an 8 point to an 8.6. 20 years of perfect selection, intensive genetic culling only improved it less than 1 point. So we didn't even go from an 8 to a 9 point. We were less than a 9 point.
So there's, I guess I like to think, Steve, of the leaky bucket. We had this bucket of genes that we were selecting for. But there's holes in the bucket. They're leaking. And so let's go back to why it didn't work. Demonstrated when you have complete control in a breeding pen, this stuff works. But now we're in a free-ranging scenario. No fence, no confinement. Deer can come and go as they please. And now we have all these reasons why that these improved, air quotes, improved, you know, genotypes, we're not seeing them. And so it comes back to half the bucks are dispersing, right?
Absolutely.
So half of those, and a lot of times more, up to 70%, they're leaving the property. And so you have other bucks, you know, dispersing into the property. We also have the situation of what we talked about with the who's your daddy. You know, that big old stud buck, he is not manipulating the breeding. So there we go again. And then one of the biggest things that differentiates the wild from a breeding pen scenario is half of the genetics come from mom, and there's no particular marker on a doe that says, I'm going to produce male offspring with really large antlers.
So let's hammer this.
Hammer it.
Genetic manipulation does not work. You cannot improve the genetic composition of a population using culling or what we like to call selective harvest. Can we hammer it?
In a free-ranging scenario, that's right.
Let's go more than hammer. Let's put in screws.
All right. Bury it. All right.
So should we cull deer? Is it part of the discussion in buck management? If it's not going to improve the genetics, should we even cull a deer population?
Well, we like to think that there is a place for buck management, selective harvest for bucks. And whether you want to use the term cull or however you want to, whatever term you want to use, yeah, we do think there is a place for it. But the purpose is different than for genetics. We don't quote cull for the purpose of improving genetics, but we can cull for the purpose of improving what we call the standing crop. The more biological term, Steve, that we would use is a cohort. So let me give a quick and dirty definition of a cohort. A cohort is a group of animals born in a specific year. So this summer in Mississippi, we are going to have the cohort of 2017 will be born. And so there will be a buck cohort of 2017, a doe cohort of 2017. Now that buck cohort of 2017 is going to grow, hopefully, on a well-managed property for the next 5, 6, or 7 years. What we try to do is, depending on your objectives, is use selective harvest to manage that cohort or manage that standing crop. Now, standing crop would also include all the cohorts within the population. So right now, we've got a 2012 cohort, a 2013 cohort, 2004. But all those bucks from all those cohorts that are alive and well and roaming around on our property is what we call the standing crop that is alive and well of bucks.
Yeah.
Did I summarize that okay?
Yeah.
We definitely, Steve, or I'll say I won't speak for you, typically have a southeastern context where in a lot of the southeast, certainly not everywhere, we'll talk about that with some predator impacts in another episode, but in a lot of the southeast, you need to kill deer.
Yes.
You have to kill deer from year to year to maintain that population, you know, at carrying capacity, or ideally a little below carrying capacity. So we want to keep the deer population such that there are enough food resources that can be allocated to each mouth, to each buck, to each doe, so that they can fulfill their genetic potential. We want them to have adequate nutrition to be able to express those genetics. One way that we can manage deer density, well, obviously, doe harvest. We can obviously reduce the doe population and reduce the deer density that way. Another way to do it is selective harvest on the bucks. And so we would look at a particular buck and say, this particular buck at 3 years of age, maybe 4 years of age, maybe 2 years of age, depending on where you're at and how much knowledge you have about the population, we can target a particular buck and say, this particular buck shows less promise for being a really good one.
Yeah.
One that's going to have average antlers or above average antlers, which is most people are looking for. So for the purpose of reducing food consumption, we need to remove mouths off the range anyway. Mm-hmm. Let's target that specific buck.
As part of population control.
As part of population control. As part of food control.
And you know, I like a lot of weird analogies. Think about the high school basketball coach. And let's say he goes and looks through all the boys in the ninth grade. And he starts recruiting for his varsity basketball team in high school. And he's probably going to do some physical evaluations just on who's has certain criteria that he's looking for. One would be speed, but an obvious one in basketball is height. So I wouldn't have been chosen as a potential recruit for the basketball team in the ninth grade. I had neither speed nor height. So he's going to have to, he only has so much time in his day to work with a certain number of students. He wants to be able to work with the ones that most likely will contribute to his varsity success. So he's going to do some selective recruiting.
All right. So let's explore that a little bit more. So in ninth grade, the basketball coach has a pretty good idea anybody would have a pretty good idea if they were to line up all those ninth grade boys from shortest to tallest, you would probably tend to look more towards the tallest young fellas in the ninth grade. More than likely, they're also going to be above average in the 10th grade, 11th grade, and 12th grade.
Yes.
Now, there's always exceptions. There's always a late bloomer. There's always the one, oh my gosh, in ninth grade, this fellow was below average and, you know, he blossomed. But on the average, that's not the case. And that's what we do with deer management, right?
That's
right. We play the averages.
You don't manage for an individual deer in a wild deer population. You can't. You might choose not to harvest an individual deer as part of a management program, but you're choosing that buck because he's of his expression of his genetics relative to the average for the population. So we don't talk about managing individuals, we manage populations.
And so we typically equate, following with your analogy, we would say a ninth grader is probably a 3.5-year-old buck.
Yeah.
Right, in that range.
Yeah.
A senior in high school is probably 5 or 6 years of age.
Yeah, actually, you know, some basketball players, and even, you know, like I personally grew several inches after I started college. And so I was a late bloomer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And some basketball players will get even taller after they get to college. But
on the average,
guys are finished growing by the time they're in the 10th grade or 11th, certainly the 11th grade.
Mm-hmm. But it certainly appears if they're way above average in ninth grade, they're probably going to be above average. If they're already 6'3 in ninth grade, they may not grow that much more. But maybe they're only 6'4 when they're in 12th grade, but
yeah,
they're still above average.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's still the attribute you're looking for. And so that can be the same way when you're managing these cohorts or these standing crops.
Yes. And maybe we're beating a dead horse here, but you know, if you go back when your children are young and they're being measured by the pediatrician, they're plotting their height and weight on a percentile graph. And they'll show, you know, such and such child is, oh, they're in the 90th percentile because they're, you know, only, 90% of the kids that age are below them in height or weight. Or they might be, they're in the 30th percentile, meaning 30% are below them and 60% are above them in height or weight. And so, you know, this concept of percentiles and characterization of body size and antler size based on age is not a new concept. It's not foreign. It's not something that we've necessarily come up with in principle, but I think what we're doing in our approach to buck management is really bringing it into the buck management world where it hasn't been practiced in the past.
Well, we try to give people a system, you know, and borrowing on what you said earlier, you're not managing for individuals. No, we try to come up with a system that year after year after year, if you implement this system, then you're going to start seeing some changes. You know, and a lot of that is selective harvest. And there's two sides to this coin, right? So there's, you got these fellas that are below average. We want to do this for food management. So these particular guys don't show much promise. They've lived to, let's just say on average, we typically say 3, but they've lived to 3 years of age. We kind of see where they're going. We kind of can see their growth trajectory, and they're really not going where we want them to go based on our management objectives. That's a great buck to harvest, fun to harvest, and it's going to eat well, right?
That's right.
So that's really, really, really way to handle that. The other side of that, though, Steve, just as important, it's not what bucks you shoot, it's what ones you don't. It's which ones you let walk. So you're selectively harvesting the ones that don't show as much promise. But at the same time, you got to turn right around and do just the opposite and make sure the ones that do show promise at ninth grade, you got to make sure they make it to be a senior.
That's right. And you know, that in essence is the key to our approach to buck management. And it is a system, and it can be understood and applied. Now, we can't describe it very quickly, so maybe we need to kind of end this podcast now and talk about in a future podcast. We're going to try to talk more about getting hunters and managers to understand what is a standing crop, clarify when and how it can be managed, and talk about some of the potential impacts and some of the potential problems using selective harvest as a management tool, because we've proven in some wild animal population research that it actually can be misapplied as well as positively applied. Right. So we got a lot to talk about on this subject. What do you say we kind of wrap this podcast up?
Yeah, I think this is a great place because where you're going, Steve, that's a whole nother, not complicated, but it'll take a lot more explaining, and you and I are going to have to figure out how to paint the picture with words, because we have a visual of, you know, what selection should look like, and we're going to have to come up with some good ways to explain that as well. So that's a great place to stop, Steve. And when we come back next time, I don't know if it'll be the next episode, but a few episodes from now, we'll go into great more detail about how to apply this. You know, if you're a hunter, how to take this information, how do you figure out which bucks need to be harvested, which ones need to be protected. And then, as Steve mentioned, we're going to show some the downside when selective harvest goes the wrong way.
Goes awry.
When it goes awry, what it can do to your deer population. So thank you, everybody, and tune in next time for Deer University. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.